Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to our last lecture for 1982. Decided tonight to call the lecture Problems and Anxieties That Beset Newcomers. Now, if you've decided you're not a newcomer, and so you feel that this lecture is irrelevant for you, please don't block off, because some of the problems that beset newcomers still plague meditators 2, 3, 4, 5 years later. So it is relevant to all of us. When a man becomes a monk, he has to make a choice between whether he wishes to focus his attention on study or on meditation. The study is called the taking up of the burden of the books, and the meditation, and the other is called the burden of the meditation. Now, there was once an English monk who'd taken on the burden of meditation. His teacher set him to practicing a specific concentration meditation where he had to continually repeat a couple of words. One day he was sitting alone in his room, meditating gently, repeating the words Samma Arahang, Samma Arahang, when suddenly he found himself tagging on to the Samma Arahang, Our Father, who art in heaven. He stopped, panic-struck, thinking that he must be losing his Buddhism, because the Christian's Lord Prayer had crept into his meditation. He rushed downstairs to his teacher and blurted out what had happened. His teacher laughed and said, "You silly so-and-so, having been brought up as a Christian, there are bound to be times when the old conditioning, which is coded into your very being, will flood back into mind. It doesn't mean you've lost your Buddhism. It's just conditioning. So regard it as thinking. It will rise and pass like everything else." Well, the monk was settled with this answer, and he returned happily to his room and his meditation. Now, Christian conditioning is one of the items that rise up and cause anxious moments for the newcomer to Vipassana meditation, particularly because Vipassana is rooted in Buddhism. There was a certain member of one of the introductory courses that we hold on a Thursday evening who was having a few problems trying to align her Christianity with Buddhism. Being aware that I had had a strict, orthodox, and intense Christian childhood and adolescence, when we came to chapter 6 of Walpole Rahula's book, it's a chapter which deals with anatta, the concept of non-self, she made the observation that because of my background, I must have had a lot of difficulty with both the theory of non-self and with the idea of there being no personal God in Buddhism. The short answer is I didn't. It didn't bother me, and there is a reason for that, which I shall go into in more detail in a moment. These two theories, they cause many a newcomer a great deal of anxiety, and I put the word theory in inverted commas, because they are not theories, but facts. However, as far as the newcomer is concerned, they are still in the realm of theories because he or she has not yet had the opportunity of testing these theories with meditative practice. The theories of anatta and no personal God challenge everything newcomers have been conditioned to since the day they were born. And even if they haven't had a particularly religious upbringing, the West is, by tradition, Christian. So there's not a person who's born in this part of the world who is not familiar with the terms God and soul. And there are as many interpretations of the meanings of these words as there are people who live in the West. However, everyone has some hazy notion of what God and soul are supposed to mean. You can travel to certain parts of the Western Hemisphere, to parts not very far from home, such as Canada or Spain. And the traveler will be asked, where do you come from? And you can reply, London, England. And it is not unknown to receive the retort, where is that? Now, strange though that may seem, there was a time when I was hitchhiking in Spain, and I got to some very remote villages. And not only had they never heard of London, but they had never even heard of England. So there are people in the West who have not heard the word England. But you'd be very hard-pressed to find someone who had not heard of the word God and soul. So we come to Buddhism with either a simplistic notion or a well-thought-out, intricate and abstract concept of the terms God and soul. However, it's actually rather rare that a person has a fully conscious, well-constructed view which they have worked out for themselves. It is by far the more common to just have conditioned in unquestionably an unquestioned belief that these things exist. So it is little wonder that we feel intense anxiety when we come across a system which claims there is no soul and no God sitting in the heavens looking down on us, who rewards and punishes us for our every action. Many find that the rest of the Buddhist teaching appeals to them, and that the meditation in particular is very attractive. But these two views, they stick in the throat somewhat, and newcomers feel very guilty, feel they are being disloyal to their inherited religion. And they wonder, seriously, if they will really be able to come to terms with this teaching. And perhaps they ought to give it up. What to do? There is only one way through this dilemma, and that is via the meditation. Once the meditator has gone beyond a certain stage in the practice, then all feelings of unease about such questions are fully allayed. However, even though their anxiety has disappeared, one may not be able to express in words the answer to the questions about non-self and no God. Should, say a stranger at a party, should they ask for an explanation, you will not necessarily be able to give them an answer. Nor will the meditator be able to understand the term anatta in all its subtlety and depth. It will need more meditation for that to occur. But the meditation will most certainly bring about a cancellation of anxiety and doubt about certain key points in Buddhism. Now, to come back to the story of why I was never bothered by the theories of non-self and no God. For it is most reasonable to assume that with my heavy Christian background, I would find these theories somewhat disturbing. The first thing I became interested in when I turned away from Christianity was Hinduism. Hinduism has a theory of God and a theory of soul. Soul they call Atman. So there's no conflict here with one's Christian background. Hinduism, in fact, sits more easily with the Westerner's mentality because it doesn't conflict with his conditioning. I always felt that the key to everything was meditation. And the Hindu ashram that I went along to in West London was frequented by people who were very serious and dedicated to the quest for truth. The standard of theoretical teaching was high, and the number of events such as lectures and study groups that one could attend per week were numerous. But the meditation instruction was very sparse. and there certainly weren't any group meditations to attend or residential courses to go on. And yet, strangely enough, meditation was the core of the teaching. The guru who came over from India and founded the ashram had died several years before I attended. And after his death, his closest disciples took over the running of the ashram. All of the books that he had written contained many chapters on meditation. In fact, there wasn't one book that totally ignored the subject. Perhaps it was because he was dead that not so much emphasis was placed on meditation. Or perhaps one had to show that one was really dedicated before being initiated into the deeper secrets of meditation. I do not know. All I know is that I attended that ashram 3 nights a week, every week, for a year. And although I loved the teaching and the people very much, I became increasingly restless at the lack of meditation instruction and just could not wait around for whatever secrets they may or may not have had in store for me. So when I came across a book that went into detail about meditation and in particular about meditation courses held in a center in Burma, it whetted my appetite. And when I subsequently visited a Buddhist monastery in East Sheen in London and heard a monk lecturing about the selfsame system of meditation that I had just read about in the book, I immediately asked to be taken on as a pupil. This particular monk was to open a meditation center in Surrey several months after I met him, and he suggested that I went on a 2-week meditation retreat. I jumped at the opportunity, being very keen to get to grips with the meditation in a wholehearted way. I knew absolutely nothing about Buddhism, and even though 2 months passed before I was due to attend the course, I did not read anything on the subject. So by the time the fortnight's retreat rolled round, I was still as ignorant as ever about the theory of Buddhism. 3 days into the course, and I hit difficulties. Great floods of doubt arose, particularly about the teacher. I said nothing about this to him, but sometime during that third day, he knocked on my door and gave me 2 articles to read. They were actually transcribed lectures. The subject matter in both articles dealt exclusively with doubt. That broke the tension. I cried solidly for a day. And then the mind went into a completely new area. It was very happy, very blissful, and experienced lots of bright lights and pretty pictures. I realized too that the doubts had been replaced by a great confidence in both the teacher and the teaching. And from that time on, I was totally sold on Buddhism. I knew it was right for me, and that no one or thing was going to prise me away from it and the meditation. However, I still knew absolutely nothing about the theory. It was some time after that course that the knowledge dawned that during those 2 weeks, I had actually come to know a great deal about the very heart of the Buddhist teaching, but from the angle where it really matters, from the experiential angle. I've gone into this long explanation about my past for the point that I'm now going to make, which is about that stage in the meditation which I reached on the third day, and how, when the stage has been passed through, all serious anxieties disappear, especially anxieties about difficult aspects of the teaching, such as anatta. It was many years before I realized what had actually taken place on that course, which was that after that painful third day, the mind passed into an area known as the stage of arising and passing away. Once a meditator reaches this stage, he or she feels happy and blissful and totally confident about the teaching. There is a wish to go out and tell the whole world about this wonderful meditation that has had such a revolutionary effect upon one's inner life. It is at this stage that all forms of anxiety and doubt about certain aspects of the teaching just melt away. So you see, I never did have a problem with the theories of non-self and no God. Such problems were solved long before I ever heard the terms. That is not to say I fully understood these concepts in all their subtlety. I did not. That took many more years of practice. But I never did experience anxiety or guilt over these two theories, because in my case, the practical experience just happened to be in advance of the intellectual knowledge. So questions were answered before they could even arise. The bottom line to this story is that all your questions are answered with the meditation practice. It is the key which unlocks all closed doors. How long does a meditator take to get to this stage of arising and passing away? It varies with each individual, and there's no way of assessing whether it will take 15 minutes after starting the practice, and such speed we have known, or 15 days, or 15 weeks, or 15 years, or 15 lifetimes, or 1500 lifetimes. Just so no misunderstanding arises, and you don't go away thinking that the stage of arising and passing away must be extremely advanced, and a difficult point to reach in the practice. Let me put it into perspective. There are four paths to this Vipassana meditation practice, and each path covers the same ground. But every time you travel along that path, you notice things you had never noticed before. And so wisdom grows more subtle and deeper on each path. On the first path, there are 19 stages. On the second path, there are 16 stages. And on the third and the fourth path, there are also 16 stages. Arising and passing away on the first path, and that is what I've been talking about up till now, is stage number 4. When arising and passing away on the first path has been reached, it is said that a meditator will take about 100 more lifetimes to finish traveling the four paths if he does no more meditative work in this lifetime. So you see, this stage is really the beginning of the journey. But having said that, there is many a mindfulness meditator who never even gets to that stage. So it is no mean achievement, even if it is right at the beginning of the practice. Of those who reach arising and passing away on the first path, some will travel all four paths within this lifetime, and some of those will travel it very quickly, well within 10 years. Of those who travel the four paths to the gateway, some will realize total enlightenment in this very lifetime. The second problem, common to all new meditators, in a lesser or greater degree, is not regarding meditation as a new skill to be learnt, and so expecting instant peace and success. A newcomer does not realize that the tension level with respect to learning how to meditate can be very high. He expects the meditation to be calm and peaceful right from the very first time he sits down and attempts it. This is because, in spite of the newcomer's lack of knowledge about the subject, he nevertheless has lurking in the recesses of his mind a picture. Perhaps the picture is of a person sitting cross-legged under a tree in a quiet forest glade, looking peaceful and serene. Even though he may have read nothing on meditation, doesn't know anyone who meditates, and has never meditated before, he's bound to have heard of the word meditation. Perhaps he's seen a picture of the Maharishi in a newspaper, along with a few key phrases describing that picture. Phrases such as stillness, incense, India, flowers. So the newcomer will start his adventure into the world of meditation with certain concepts conditioned in. And the main words that will be associated with meditation, whether the person realizes it or not, will be stillness and peace. So with these ideas floating around, it comes as a shock to the newcomer when he sits down, closes his eyes, and all he is aware of is the mind buzzing around from one thought to another. There's no peace, no stillness, and certainly no capacity to keep the mind pinned on rise and fall. The meditator gets dejected, especially when 1 week goes past, then two, then 1 month, then two, and the situation is still the same, with the mind darting hither and yon with very little settledness. And all the meditator notices is that in trying to bring the wayward mind back to rise and fall, a lot of tension is produced. The psychological process in learning to meditate is the same as with any new task one is trying to master. Take, for example, learning to drive a car. For quite some time after you've started to learn, you feel all arms and legs. You feel you'll never get the coordination right. There seem so many things to remember and to do all at once. And during those driving lessons, you'll feel tense. And when the lesson's finished, you'll feel overwhelmed or worn out. But you persist, and after many a lesson, one day, all of a sudden, you realize your arms and legs are coordinating. You've got the hang of it. The car's not jerking around so much. You feel you've got more control over it. You're less tense. It still takes many a driving lesson after this point before you're really at ease with the car. And then several more months after you've passed your test before there's complete ease with the vehicle. Then one day you realize with surprise that driving has gone onto automatic and you're not even thinking about the process. During those first few traumatic lessons, you would never have believed that such a state was possible. But by the time the driving process has gone on to automatic, the tension has disappeared. And to your surprise, you actually enjoy driving. The same psychological process occurs with trying to ride a bicycle, with any do-it-yourself job around the house, with learning to swim or climb a mountain, in fact, with any new task. To start with, you feel there's so much to learn that you'll never get the hang of it. And the enjoyment of learning is tainted by the high tension level. And so it is with meditation. The process is exactly the same. Because it's new and you haven't done it before, you're anxious and tense. And it takes many a repetition of your half-hour seated practice before you start to feel more at ease with meditation. There was once a gentleman who joined us for one of the introductory courses. He was slightly different from most people who find their way to us in that he had never meditated before, had no religious or philosophical background, and had never even pondered these subjects. And he hadn't had any contact with someone who is interested in one of those topics that are subscribed to by only a small percentage of the country's population. Topics such as healing or spiritualism or astrology or psychology. In short, he really was a beginner. He'd seen a television program about a Buddhist monastery in Sussex and was very impressed with the inner peacefulness that the monks displayed and decided he'd like some of that. This is what drove him to start meditating and to join one of the courses. As soon as he started, he realized there was no peace in his mind. It was unruly and it indulged in thinking. He found meditation unpleasant. He was tense, and the unruliness of his mind frightened him. We saw him after 2 weeks for meditation report. During that time, he'd only sat to practice for 10 minutes every third day. He decided to give up because he found looking at the content of his mind such an unpleasant experience. And in his eyes, to add insult to injury, the meditation wasn't solving his life's problems. This man had a totally unrealistic attitude to learning. He had been living for 28 years with a mind indulging in all sorts of inefficient habits, but he expected that the first time he sat down and closed his eyes and started to meditate, that those habits would somehow magically be allayed by the meditation, and in their place would be peace, stillness, and pleasant feelings. His attitude was equivalent to expecting some sort of fairy godmother to come along, wave a wand, and take all his troubles and mental inefficiencies away in one sweep of her wand. Unfortunately, meditation doesn't work like that. What we have created mentally, we can tear down if we don't like it. But it takes patience, gentleness, and most important of all, constant repetition. It also takes a realism of accepting and working through the initial tension of learning a new skill. When you start to meditate, should you feel inadequate and think you must be the slowest and worst person in the class, because you have no stillness or control over this unruly mind? And the act of attempting to bring order into chaos is very tense-making. Just remember, everyone goes through the same thing when they start. It is a natural process of the mind. You are not abnormal. You are normal. If the person next to you appears to be doing marvelously well, do bear in mind that he or she may have spent several years doing a concentration meditation under the guidance of another teacher, and so have already gone over the initial tense learning difficulties and have developed a certain skill with the task of concentration, so is more at ease with the meditation. A further hurdle to overcome for the newcomer is the language used to express this teaching. Because it's in English, and we all understand English, the newcomer immediately assumes that he should be able to understand, more or less, everything that is said. When he discovers that most of it goes over his head, his anxiety rises. He immediately thinks, "I'm not very bright. I obviously don't have sufficient intellectual capacity to deal with this teaching. As I'm so stupid, I'm obviously not going to get anywhere. The teacher's reassuring comments of all will be understood through the meditation does little to allay the anxiety. What the newcomer doesn't realize is that even though the words are in English, the concepts and experiences being described are alien to his way of thinking and experiencing. What he has done is he has introduced himself to a new language. And if he were to undertake to learn Arabic, or Chinese, or Spanish, he would not think it unreasonable to have to spend many hours poring over study books, struggling and sweating with the language, in the hopes of developing an ease and a familiarity with his new subject. And just because he is struggling, he wouldn't immediately think he was stupid and lacking in intelligence. He would expect to struggle when he started to learn a new language. And so it should be with Tamma. It is a new language. You should expect to struggle when you start. You should expect to spend many hours poring over the books, studying lists, and listening to lecture after lecture before the subject will gel for you. Do not be fooled because it is in English. The concepts are new. The way the words are strung together to describe those concepts is new, and just as difficult as struggling with verbs and nouns and adjectives in a foreign language. And to make matters more difficult, the meditation is also new. So it is as if you have decided to go to night school to learn two new languages, one called meditation and the other called Tamma language. And as a true understanding of the Tamma language is only possible through the meditation, it is upon the meditation that everything hinges. The fact that you can say, this apple is juicy. How much are those potatoes? Where is the windscreen wiper switch in this car? Wittgenstein's philosophy is superior to Whitehead's because, etc., etc. All of this language is useless for understanding Tamma. Because the language we are familiar with when we come to Buddhism describes things and events in our everyday world, in our outer physical world. When you come to Dhamma, you have started a journey into a new world, an inner world, and you must learn the language appropriate to that world if you are going to get the best out of it. And as with the meditation, be prepared to struggle to start with, and that struggle will produce attention. But what you will also notice is that as you begin to get to grips with this new language, the tension and anxiety reduces, and you are no longer plagued with thoughts of, I'm not intelligent enough, but instead are filled with an admiration for the precision of the language and how accurately it describes the processes of mind. Thank you.